Okay, good afternoon. Now we have A.K.S. Burin. I have the pleasure to be his her chairman. She's a practicing barrister, so she has the participant's perspective, and also has a bachelor of civil law, right, in Oxford. The title of her presentation is State Responsibility for Failure to Protect and Natural Language Argumentation. Now is your time. Thank you for being here.
And thank you, Diego, and the organizers of this conference for this really wonderful opportunity to present my work, and most of all, to get your feedback and comments on it. So thank you in advance for those. As Diego said, I practice law, and that was where this paper started. So I wanted to understand the mysterious duty that derives from the European Court of Human Rights case called Osman against the United Kingdom. And what I really hoped was that either this duty would be explained in the doctrine, or that somebody else would have written the textbook that would have made everything clear. Unfortunately, that was not to be, and hence you have my rambling attempt to make sense of the cause of action. And that's the aim of my paper. It's really to try and present in the most sensible way this cause of action, because I think that kind of clarity is missing in the case law. And you might think that I don't succeed. You might think that the law is an irreconcilable mess, but I hope after this paper it will make slightly more sense than otherwise. So this is how the duty was formulated in Osman against the UK. Where the authorities knew or ought to have known of a real and immediate risk of serious harm to an identified individual or individuals from the criminal acts of a third party, they must take measures within the scope of their powers, which, judged reasonably, might have been expected to avoid that risk. And I call this the positive duty of prevention. Now, there's three things I want you to note about this duty. First, it's incredibly wide application in terms of the convention articles. So Osman was decided primarily under Article 2, which is the right to life, but it now applies to Article 3, which is the right to be free from torture or inhuman and degrading treatment and suffering. Also 4, also 8, right to private and family life, and arguably to Article 6 as well, which is the right to a fair trial. It also has an incredibly wide application in terms of defendants. It's been applied against the police, against municipal authorities in their capacity as social landlords and as carers of vulnerable adults and children, schools, prison authorities, and hospitals. The third thing is it has a very wide application in terms of the factual scenarios. For example, you'll have noticed that the type of serious harm is not specified. In Osman, it was presumed to be harm to life, but of course, now subsequent cases have expanded that. So I'll briefly explain the facts of a few cases to give you a flavor of the kinds of scenarios in which this applies. You may well know that Osman was a case where a teacher called Paget Lewis formed an unhealthy attraction to a pupil. He was fired from his role as a teacher, and there were complaints made to the police. Tragically, this culminated in him coming to the pupil's house, killing the pupil's father, and seriously injuring the pupil himself. There have been other recent cases. Including the Supreme Court case in the United Kingdom of Michael and the Chief Constable. That was a case where Ms. Michael had been threatened by her former boyfriend. She called 999 and said that he had threatened to come back to her home shortly and to kill her. Subsequently, she made a call to 999. There was a scream, and then the phone went dead. When the police attended the house, she had in fact been killed by her former partner. in a case called Thompson against the Scottish ministers. It had very similar facts to, for example, Mastro Matteo against Italy, which was a European Court of Human Rights case. It involved the decision by the prison authorities to release on parole a prisoner who posed a risk to the women of a certain neighborhood. Immediately that he went on parole, that prisoner went to that neighborhood and killed a woman. And finally, the latitude in all of this, for me, comes to a head in a case called Bedford against Bedfordshire County Council. Now, Bedfordshire County Council is the municipal authority in a region of Britain, and that authority had a statutory duty to look after children in its area who were vulnerable or orphans or homeless for whatever reason. Now, there was a young man called A.H. who was in the local authority's care, and A.H. was known to abuse drugs and alcohol, and he also had a criminal record. Now, when he was taken on an outing, he escaped from the supervision of the local authority and the care home, and he went to a town where he beat almost to death the claimant, who was Master Bedford. And that case was pleaded in the UK High Court exclusively under Article 8, which is the right to private and family life. And the idea, it seemed, was to try and avoid the Osmond test, which was described as being stringent. It was said that there's simply a freestanding positive duty under Article 8 to protect the claimant from this kind of harm. And the UK High Court said that that was not the case. There was such a duty, but it was identical to the duty in Osmond under Articles 2, 3, etc. And of course, Osmond itself was pleaded under Article 8. So you could say that Bedford has been the law since Osmond, but no one noticed. However, whatever you might feel about the doctrinal inadequacies of the law as I've just described it, the focus is the fact that it's nebulous and extraordinarily wide-ranging. I want to put aside the doctrinal difficulties, which I do deal with in the first part of the paper, and just try and understand this doctrine in its best light. When I looked at the doctrine, I found this extraordinary statement by Judge Pinto de Albuquerque. He said, put simply, the state answers for the wrongful conduct of non-state actors when their conduct was foreseeable and avoidable by the exercise of state powers. And that seems to me quite extreme, because the conduct does not have to be actually foreseen, just has to be foreseeable and avoidable. That seems to make the state almost strictly liable for things that happen in its jurisdiction. So I tried to examine this cause of action through the perspective of natural language. And I'm now talking about section 5.3.2 of my paper, which is really, you might wonder why I bothered with the other 60 pages. Anyway, so in that section, I argue that this cause of action is a distinct kind of wrong. And the features I want to explain about it are the following. One, why it's a wrong that can only be committed by the state. Two, how the serious harm that must result is not specified. Three, how it can be brought under so many and so varied convention articles. And four, whether the particular convention article has any bearing on the duty at all, or whether the duty is now absolutely untethered and as broad as Judge Pinto de Albuquerque expressed it. And please note that what I'm describing are the structural features of the wrong when a positive duty of prevention is breached. The allegations I'm describing are not necessarily successful allegations. So what I'm trying to describe is the basis of responsibility rather than the attribution of liability, if you like. So to give an example, just as saying you slandered me succeeds as an allegation in tort, you cuckolded me does not. They have a similar semantic structure, though. So what I want to ask is who the duty bearer is, and what's the duty, and why does it fall to them to fulfill? This still leaves room for constraints on the cause of action, like the need for a real and immediate risk. What I argue is that all of the cases, Osman, Michael, Thompson, Bedford, have the same essential complaint in common. And the accusation is not like, you hit me, but rather, you did not stop him from hitting me. And I argue that this is a fundamental difference, and it goes to the nature of the wrong. So the first thing to notice about the statement is who is speaking and who is spoken to. In legal terms, who is the claimant, who is the defendant. Interposed in the allegation, you did not stop him, is a sense of responsibility toward the claimant and for the perpetrator of the harm. So the identity of the defendant is important. Only the state will really be in a position to have such broad-ranging responsibility both for and toward diverse individuals, strangers. The second thing to notice is the importance of the description of the wrong in the statement. To see this, you can substitute the verb hit in the accusations. So in the first kind of accusation, it significantly changes the character when you substitute the verb hit, because to say you killed me is a very different description of what occurred and why it was wrong. And compare this again to you detained me, or you slandered me, or you cuckolded me. In these examples, again, changing the description of the allegation changes the nature of the wrong. And they also change the person who's spoken to, because they're addressed directly to the perpetrator. And I say, by contrast, it matters less what verb, act, you say the state failed to prevent from happening, because the description of the omission remains constant across the different iterations of the second type of accusation. So if you say you did not stop him from fieing me, fie can be substituted by hit, kill, without really changing the structure of the accusation, because it's not the third party's behavior that's the focus of the description. Attention is instead directed at the fact of the failure to stop it. So when the allegation is addressed to a third party, the commission of each verb act would require a different explanation about what was wrong, and the allegation addressed to the state, how the wrong is committed and what makes it a wrong, is much less dependent on the specific implications of the verb act represented by phi. But on this description, the convention article is not yet in the picture, and it doesn't really resist enough, to my mind, Judge Pinto's type formulation. So where does the convention article fit into the picture? In the paper, I argue that the act complained of must breach the protected right rather than merely bringing about prohibited consequences that can be linked to the interest protected by that right. So it's not just Article 2, life equals don't die, Article 3 equals don't get hurt, Article 8 equals also don't get hurt in some sense. Because it has to be the state that breaches the right. It's not the third party perpetrator that breaches the right. I think that the bad outcome is still relevant. It's still in the picture because it's indicative that the third party posed a threat to the claimant's protected convention interest and that the state did not protect that interest sufficiently. So to summarize where we are in this, the kind of complaint that you might make in a PDP case is like this. Addressed to the state, by your disregard of my convention right, a wrong was done to me by someone else. So I see that as explaining the essential features of the primary allegation, but I think that natural language can shed further light because we can consider the intuitive response to this kind of allegation. And if we imagine this being played out in real life, so faced with an accusation of you did not stop him from fying me, there are two obvious responses to my mind. And the first response is, how could I stop him? Second is, why should I stop him? So as to the first question, how could I stop him? The accuser's reply would have to be by an act of governance for this to count, I say, as a breach of a PDP. And as to the second question, why should I stop him? The accuser's reply would have to focus somehow on the responsibility toward the claimant and for the defendant. So just again to recap, you did not stop him from firing me. How? By an act of governance. Why should I? Because of your responsibility toward me and for him. And I say that the response of the responsibility gives the accuser the essential ingredients to say you should have stopped him because you have a duty. I'll give an example now of some kinds of acts of governance from the cases that I've discussed. So in Bedford, the alleged effective act of governance was the supervision of the care home by the local authority. In Michael, it was the response of the emergency services to Ms. Michael's 999 call. In Thompson, it was the decision to release a prisoner, and so on. I want to look at this now in an applied example. It's a real example, and it comes from the Norwegian Supreme Court case. It's a case called NN, but it could equally be from any number of European Court of Human Rights cases that I discuss in the first part of the paper. So, the accuser would say, and this is a case about domestic violence and failure of the state to prosecute the spouse who was stalking the complainant, NN. So NN would say, you did not stop him stalking me. Being stalked poses a threat to a protected aspect of my existence, that is my private and family life and psychological integrity, insofar as that's dependent on my and my children's domestic security. My and my children's domestic security is an interest protected by Article 8. And as a consequence of your failure, I suffered mental distress. Again, note that that's not physical harm. That's quite a broad concept of the serious harm. The state would respond, how should I have stopped him? So the question, you'll note that the question, how should I have stopped him, can be answered in a more compact or a more broad way. The question could be, in what circumstances should I have stopped him and what should I have done? And then that builds in the familiar parts of the Osmond test, like where you knew or ought to have known of a serious... Blah, 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 blah. So when the defendant asks, how should I have stopped him? The accuser responds by prosecuting breaches of the restraining order, which is an act of governance. And then the accuser would again respond, well, why should I have stopped him? And it's interesting to note that this kind of argument is actually deployed in cases. So states sometimes raise this point explicitly in relation to liability. So in a case called Kalucha against Hungary, the respondent state argued that the claimant's claim, also relating to domestic violence, was inadmissible because the claimant had not availed herself of enough domestic remedies. The government in that case argued that even though she'd submitted criminal complaints for harassment, assault, and trespass, she hadn't pursued all of these. And she hadn't pursued any civil remedies against the spouse herself. So the government effectively endeavored to place the responsibility for the act of governance back on the claimant. Anyway, in faced with the kind of why should I have stopped him question, the accuser would say, because of your responsibility for him and toward me, i.e. you had a duty. So I now just want to conclude. I argue that the breach of a positive duty of protection is not only a wrong, but it's a wrong of a particular kind. It's a distinct wrong from the wrong carried out by a third-party perpetrator. What I intended to do was examine the nature of the essential complaint, which I say is the same in every PDP case, and to reveal the following features. The act complained of is a failure of governance that implicates a convention right. The convention right is implicated because the state's failure manifests a disregard for a protected aspect of human existence, which is a right or interest protected by the convention. The conduct of the third party bears on the complaint insofar as the third party's conduct poses a threat to the protected aspect of the claimant's existence, and the harm inflicted is therefore consequent on the state's failure of governance. So in very basic terms, what is the state responsible for and why? What the state is responsible for its own act of governance, or a defective act of governance, or non-feasance of an act of governance? And why? Because this demonstrates a disrespect for a convention right of the claimants. As I say, you could still conclude that this is too convoluted and the positive duty is just too much of a mess. But I think if sense can be made, it would be made through an analysis like this.